Someone has said that marriage is like turning handsprings, learning to eat with chopsticks. It looks easy until you try it. And this is true. It is easy until you try it. And yet, aside from our walk with God, marriage is the greatest of all adventures. And one of the adventures that we face is really beginning to know one another. Elizabeth Elliot, in her little book, Discipline the Glad Surrender, tells this little incident. A couple I know had been married only a week or two when the wife went out shopping. The husband wondered what he might do for her while she was gone that would please and surprise her and show her how much he loved her. A brilliant plan came to his mind. He got down on his hands and knees and scrubbed the kitchen floor. It was a demeaning task, in his opinion, and he felt exceedingly humble while performing it. How amazed Anne would be. He waited in eager anticipation for her return, thinking how blessed it is to give. She drove in the driveway, breezed into the kitchen, set the grocery bags on the counter, and glanced at the floor. "Oh, the floor's clean. Thank you, honey," was all she said, and went about putting things away. The man told me he went into a 3-day funk. He was hurt. He was insulted. He was not properly appreciated, and the blessing of giving drained out in an instant because he had not received the kind of thanks he had expected. Anne had no idea what the trouble was. What she did not know was that her husband had never heard of a man's doing such a thing as scrubbing a floor for his wife, especially voluntarily, having thought of it all by himself. What he did not know was that in his wife's family, no woman ever did the job. Her father considered it a man's job and did it as a matter of course. Little things, and yet little things like this can begin to drive us apart if we don't know and study one another. Proverbs 3:32 in the Phillips translation says, "Be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you." Three imperative commands, especially for a marriage. If we could just do these three consistently, we'd probably have the happiest marriages going, wouldn't we? Be kind to one another. We are the least kind to those we love the most, very often. And if you don't believe me, just listen to mothers in supermarkets. A little poem goes, "They were single and went walking, and her heart did skip a beat. As she stumbled on the sidewalk, he murmured, 'Careful, sweet.' Now the wedding bells have rung, and when they walk the selfsame street, when she stumbles on the sidewalk, he just yells, 'Pick up your feet.'" You know, it's too true. And then it says, "Be understanding." A man once said, "A long life is barely enough for a man and a woman to understand each other." And to be understood is to love. The man who understands one woman is qualified to understand pretty well everything. And the reverse is true. And yet, when Adam was lonely, God made for him not 10 friends, but 1 wife. And I'm glad. And then the third command in this says, "Be forgiving." This is where some of us need to start. Often in a relationship, tense with past troubles, we're hurt, and we start to build up little walls around our emotions. The scar tissue gets thick, and we're hurt again, and that wall becomes a little thicker, a little higher, until we're simply not communicating, we're not loving, we're not experiencing what God has for us in this wonderful adventure called marriage. And you know, friends, in ourselves, we can't forgive. We're unable to forgive when the walls get so thick in ourselves. But with God, we can. With God, nothing is impossible. With God, all things are possible. And so we need to really take that before the Lord if that's your problem. And you're having trouble really forgiving something from the past. And just go to the Lord and say, "Lord, I can't, but you can through me." And I can't trust him again, or I can't trust her again, not to hurt me. But Lord, I can trust you for that one. And so, by your grace, I will forgive. And then say to that loved one, honey, let's start again. Let's ask God to break down those walls, to tear down that thing that's separating us. And with his grace, to start again. Be forgiving. That's a command. And it says, be forgiving as much as God for Christ's sake has forgiven us. Well, how much has God for Christ's sake forgiven you? Everything. Totally. So we are to forgive. One man said, when we quarrel, my wife becomes historical. And his friend said, don't you mean hysterical? And he says, no, I mean historical. She brings up everything I ever did. And yet Proverbs says, love forgets mistakes. Nagging about them parts the best of friends. So we are to forgive. But let's go back to understanding. One minister's wife said this, if I could give one piece of advice, and only one, to women, it would be this. Study your man. Study him as if he were some rare and strange and fascinating animal, which he is. Study his likes and dislikes, his strengths and weaknesses, his moods and mannerisms. Just loving a man is fine, but it's not enough. To live with one successfully, you have to know him. And to know him, you have to study him. Look around you and decide how many of the best marriages you know are ones where a wife, in a deep sense, actually knows her husband better than he knows himself. Knows what pleases him. Knows what upsets him. Knows what makes him laugh or makes him angry. Knows when he needs encouragement. Knows when he's too charged up about something and needs to be held back. Knows, in other words, exactly what makes him tick. Do you wives know your husband like that? Do you husbands know your wives like that? That is our task. Now, I'm going to explain just four differences between Jack and me. I could tell you 100. But we're just going to start with four. And our prayer is that you will use this as a springboard, as a beginning for a lifetime of study. That you will begin to identify yourself, and then you will begin to identify that person that God has given you. That you might begin to complete each other, to become a couple that can see things in the round. Jack is a very objective person. And I am a very subjective person. To Jack, a fact is a fact is a fact. He takes a detached view of things. To Jack, a fact is a fact is a fact. And he can take more of a detached view of things than I can. To me, a fact is slightly more than a fact or slightly less than a fact, depending on what mood I am in. And I have a hard time being detached about anything. Now, this has all kinds, this one little thing has all kinds of implications in our relationship. Jack will be meeting with a group of men in the living room, and all of a sudden they begin to disagree. I mean, they're really disagreeing. And I'm in the kitchen making coffee, and I'm thinking, oh, they're about to come to blows. Next minute, laughing, patting each other on the back, best of friends. That is Jack's objectivity. However, I have also learned that should I say those very same things to Jack, he loses his objectivity. Now, this comes up every day. A man and a woman will come over our house for dinner, and the man will say, where'd you get this meat? And Jack will say, well, down at the corner grocery. And I'll say, why? What's wrong with it? You do that? Jack will say, the Joneses are busy and can't come tomorrow. And I'll say, I wonder what we did to offend them. Now, friends, subjective people do not take teasing well. There's absolutely no way that Jack can come in the door and say, hi, chubby, that I don't take it personally. Jack is a very essential-minded person. I am a very detail-minded person. Jack focuses in on the main subject, the most important thing to be considered. I think in detail. I see the minutia of things. Here again, this causes some very interesting situations. Jack used to go away to a week-long conference. I say used to because we get to travel most of the time together now. But he would go away for a week-long conference, and I would stay home with our small daughter, the dog, the washing machine, dial a prayer. And by the time he would come in through the front door, I would be starved for adult communication. And so I would greet him with a big hug and a kiss, and I would say, "Tell me all about that conference." And he would tell me all about that conference in 10 minutes flat. And I would think, oh, he does not care enough to tell me about that conference. And the way my mind works, it goes, well, and if he doesn't care enough to tell me about that conference, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. Now, friends, I was wrong. But I have spent hours, maybe literally days, crying over this because I thought the way he approached things was wrong, not different. And it had to do with his love for me. On the other hand, I would start to tell him a story, you know, about the neighbor down the street. He was the one that ran for Congress 3 years ago. And you remember his mother-in-law ended up in the insane asylum. And she was, and just about this time I look at him and his eyes are sort of crossed and glazed over. And I'm thinking, he's not listening. And I'm right. And the way my mind goes is, if he's not listening, then he's not interested in what I'm interested in. And if he's not interested in what I'm interested in, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. Now, friends, we've come a ways. I realize that in Jack's way, he had told me all about that conference. Do you see why? He had zeroed in on the main things. The most important things to be considered. That is his essential mindedness coming out. And so he had told me all about that conference. Now he is learning to keep track of the really important things. You know, like who's going to have babies and who got engaged and the most important meal he had. Some of those really important things. And yet I want you to know that I have learned how to boil a juicy 4-hour story down to 10 minutes flat. And yet there are times when Jack realizes I've got to get it all out. And he's trained himself to listen. And I love him for it. And that's the way we've begun to change and help each other. Detail-minded people are impressed by and distracted by little things. Jack will say, "That's a good-looking car. But how does it run?" That's the essential point, isn't it? I'll say, "I just don't like the color." That's the detail. Jack will say, "I like that speaker's ideas." And I'll say, "Did you notice that his shirt matched his tie?" Now I'm exaggerating, but just a little. And it wasn't that I didn't notice the speaker's ideas. It was that I noticed another detail too. Not wrong, just different. Jack is a very logical person. I am a very emotional person. Jack is inclined to study the evidence and in a step-by-step reasoning process reach a conclusion. I rely on my intuition, my instinct, my emotion to reach a conclusion. Many times, friends, the same conclusion. And my way's faster. Now... Friends, let me tell you a couple of things of how wonderfully these two relate to one another. Someone has said that actually a woman's intuition or anyone's intuition is really a mind for detail. And I think there's a lot of truth to this. In other words, Jack and I can go into the same situation and notice two completely different sets of things. I see that raised eyebrow. I'm aware of that tone of voice. I pick up that body posture. And these 20 little details filter through the computer of my mind and come out an intuition, if you will, a feeling. Jack notices different things. And so we come away from a situation, and many times Jack will say, "How did you feel about that situation?" Now, I can't tell him that I saw that raised eyebrow and was aware of that tone of voice. I just tell him how I felt about that situation. He filters that through his very objective grid. We can go back into that situation, ask some other questions, and you see we come out with that picture in the round. Isn't that great? That's the way God has wired us together in order to fit together. Now, logical people can seem to emotional people to be detached. They can seem not to be as interested in people as emotional people are. And I've struggled in the past, frankly, with this one, thinking, why doesn't he get more involved? Just yesterday, I had cause to thank God that my husband is the way he is. Here I go. We've been involved in a situation that has a very distressing situation that has actually put me on emotional overload. And yesterday, as Jack and I were talking about it, honey, he said, "Honey, being involved in the conference this week and the other things that we are involved in, we've got to stay detached." And I said it to myself, detached? You know, how do I do that? He answered my unspoken question by saying, "Honey, I really want to protect you in this." And I said, "You know, well, what am I supposed to do when she calls?" And he said, "Just say, I'll let you talk to Jack." As I got to thinking about that, I thought, how wonderful that God has given me a man who can handle more emotion, actually, than I can, because he doesn't get so totally involved. Actually, Jack has a higher capacity to handle a multiple number of things emotionally because he can stay detached. I throw myself right smack into the middle, and that's about all I can handle, or I go on overload. And I was walking up the stairs, and I said, "Lord, how I praise you that I can take this great big burden, emotional burden, and hand it to somebody else with skin on. I know I can hand it to you, but I kind of need sometimes one to hand it over to that's got skin on." And then I thought, who does Jack hand it to? Well, he can hand it to the Lord. He can hand it, and we can share it. But actually, he doesn't have anybody with skin on to handle it. The buck stops there. And I thought, wow, if he wasn't able to stay a little bit detached, he maybe couldn't handle a lot of the things that are thrown at him, including me. We talked just 2 weeks ago to a fellow who wasn't like Jack, was just the opposite of Jack. He was a very sensitive kind of emotional person, wanted to go into counseling, and will make a great counselor. And they were having a difficult time because of this characteristic. You see, he just a couple of years ago had been an escort officer. He was with the Air Force at that time. And a buddy of his had been killed. And so he had the job of escorting the body home and being with the wife and family for a week. He got himself so emotionally involved in that situation. He had so identified with that, that when he came home the day before Christmas, he simply bombed out. He couldn't relate to his wife. He couldn't relate to his family on Christmas. And his wife was struggling with that. There was some jealousy there, but she was just struggling that he had spent his emotional energy and there wasn't any left for the wife and for the family. And as we talked about that, we saw what a beautiful gift God had given him, and yet what kind of parameters he was going to have to put on that gift. For two reasons. One, that he would have the emotional capacity left for his wife and family. but secondly, to avoid emotional entanglements in his emotional involvement. So I had cause yesterday to just hold up my hands and say, thank you, Lord. This is a characteristic that I haven't always understood. But thank you that you have given me the husband that is more logical for this very emotional life. Now, logical people think in a straight line, like that. Emotional people think all around the subject. And we talk that way too, obviously. By now, you can tell that. Now, I might say before we were to go out to dinner, I suppose I ought to go change. And Jack will say, well, why don't you? And I'll say, don't you like what I've got on? And he'll say, well, it's okay, but you said you were going to change. And I'll say, I was just saying that to see if it was okay not to. Now, isn't that awful? We're going to be talking about communication on Thursday, and the primary rule of communication is to say what you mean and mean what you say. But you see, I'm never going to get there. I'm working on it. Now, I've often tried to analyze why I do that. And the fact is, I really don't know, but I do have a clue. One fact is, this emotional nature, you see, I am so afraid that I might hurt you by something that I would say, or that you might hurt me, that I skirt issues. I go around the Robin Hood barn to get there. It also is why I have got to hear emotion, or I may not believe things. I used to go out and buy a dress, the first little overhead I had. And I would come home and I would say, honey, how do you like my dress? And he would say, I like it. And I'd take it back. I didn't really believe him. He didn't get emotion into his voice. He's working on that too. Because if I looked at his shirt and said, I like it, he know it, I just hate it. Because I haven't said, oh, beautiful, I love that color. Oh, that's so good on you. It's just right. Not wrong, my friends. Just different. Now, fourthly, Jack uses speech to convey facts and ideas. I use speech to convey feelings and emotions. Many times I do. You're looking at an absolutely gorgeous moon, and I look up at it and I say, oh, isn't that a gorgeous moon? Well, what am I saying? I'm saying that moon makes me feel romantic. And if Jack comes back with, yes, that's bright enough to shoot a golf ball by, I'm hurt. Actually, he did say that one time, but he was smiling. He knew. It's raining outside, and I look outside and I say, oh, it's raining outside. Oh, what am I saying? I could be saying a number of things. I could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel energetic. I'm going to clean house like crazy all day. I could be saying, oh, it's raining outside. That makes me feel depressed. But chances are I'm expressing a feeling. Jack looks outside. He says, it's raining outside. What is he saying? The heavens have parted and little drops of moisture are falling to the ground. He is expressing a fact. I am expressing a feeling. Now, if we don't understand this about each other, we can get into all kinds of trouble. I was studying this little characteristic when I backed the car out of the garage one day a little hastily. And I took a piece of the garage with the back fender. And I came into the house and I said, oh, honey, it feels just awful. You can't imagine what it was like when that car went crunch. And he stopped me just like that. And he said, never mind that. What happened? First thought that went into my head was, he doesn't care. He doesn't care how I feel. And if he doesn't care how I feel, then he must not love me the way I long to be loved. But you see, by this time I'd begun to study my husband. And so the second thought that came into my head was, no, Carol, that's not true. He just needs the facts first. He'll listen to your feelings after that, and that's okay. And that's what happened. So instead of spending all day feeling unloved and hurt and crying and having to get this out, it was resolved simply because I realized my husband was different. His approach is different, and that's okay. Now, take out a pencil and paper if you haven't got one out. I'm going to give you a little quiz. How well do you know each other? This is just a fun quiz. No fighting. And no looking at each other's papers, okay? Number one, what is your spouse's favorite color? What is your spouse's favorite color? Okay? If they don't have a favorite color, that is an answer. But like I said, no fighting. At the back of one seminar, we heard one husband say, "You don't know my favorite color?" Hello. We started already. Okay, number two. What is your spouse's favorite foreign food? Italian, Chinese, Southern fried chicken doesn't count. Okay. What is your spouse's favorite foreign food?
A nationality or specific?
Either one you want. Nationality is fine. Okay, three. What is the color of your spouse's toothbrush? If you use the same one, why, that's easy. But we don't. Okay, you got those? Stand up and compare answers. How many of you got them all right? Not too bad. Congratulations. We could have given you one such as, what is the thing that's weighing heaviest on your spouse's heart right now? Maybe you'd want to ask that one this afternoon, some of you. What is the thing that's weighing heaviest on their heart right now? By the way, my husband told me that I misquoted one of the verses I gave you, and I don't want to do that. I said Proverbs 4:32. It's Ephesians 4:32. Be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. That's the Phillips translation. Have you discovered yet your language of love and your spouse's language of love? Several counselors now tell us that this is one of the first things we ought to be discovering about one another. Because if we don't discover the language of love in which our spouse speaks, we're not going to be able to develop the secondary languages of love that will forge your relationship together. Now, what do I mean? Well, let me give several of them to you. One counselor gives five. Jack and I have added a couple. The languages of love that he suggests are, first of all, words. Words is a language of love, what you say. And so many times wives will say, "He doesn't say I love you. I need to hear it." And to them, the language of love that they hear the best is the words. But he's giving out another language of love. So words can be a primary language of love. Touch is another language of love. Time is a third language of love. And here again, I hear wives say, he does all the right things, but he doesn't spend time with me. And they're not hearing love. Gifts. Some husbands and wives are always giving each other little gifts, and it may be a language of love that you are expressing and the other person is not hearing. So what is your language of love? Is it gifts? And a fifth language of love that this counselor suggests is deeds. Now, what's the difference between deeds and gifts? Well, a deed could be that husband that is killing himself at the office to support his wife and kids. And sometimes his wife and kids do not hear that language of love at all. because they want it said in the other languages of love. But he is working at the deeds. Now, Jack and I have added a couple. The way Jack, probably one of the primary ways Jack hears my love is when he knows I am 100% with him. My loyalty. When he asks me the question, honey, are you really with me in this? I realize that I've not conveyed to him that loyalty. And that's the way he hears love. Now, I don't mean that Jack and I don't talk about everything, and I don't mean that I'm not free to disagree with him. But I do mean that when we've decided to go in a certain direction, that he knows I'm going to say, okay, honey, I'm 100% with you in this. Let's do it. And I want to be that, because that's the way he hears love. I hear love probably primarily through his acceptance of me. I just can't tell you how much I appreciate that, because I realize I'm kind of a nut in a lot of ways. But to my remembrance, I can never remember Jack saying, honey, that's got to be the weirdest thing you ever came up with. I feel his acceptance, which has done a number of things. It's freed me to be me, but it's also conveyed his love for me in his acceptance. So this afternoon, you may want to just talk about that a little bit with your spouse. What is the primary way that you express love? And what is the primary way that you think your spouse gives love, expresses love? Interesting one on that. Another thing you may want to discuss. You see, these are the types of things that you need to be learning all the time. Recently, I read a couple of books by a secular author. One of them was called Passive Men, Wild Women. I like that. He's also written a book called Thank God It's Monday. And his primary thesis of these two books is, and he calls this a man-woman difference. It may or may not be, and it doesn't really matter if it is. It's just the fact that he sees so many in counseling, that when men come home from work, his theory is that most men want to drop out for a while. They want to drop out of the relationships. They don't want to talk. They want to just drop out of life for a time. Most women, even though they may be working outside the home, when they come home, they have an intense need to drop in to the marriage, to the intimacy of that relationship, to whatever's going around them. He says this causes major conflicts and leads to divorce, because there it is again, the woman's pressing the husband to meet needs and he's backing away, and she presses and he backs away until the relationship is destroyed. And of course, a lot of mothers that stay home with their small children have an intense need for the husbands to drop in right away and to help with the kids while they get dinner on the table and so on. In fact, I have a dear, dear friend who has four little stair steps, and her husband comes home and she just is desperate to get these kids off her back for a while. And instead, her husband sits down and starts reading the paper, tunes everything out. See, he's dropping out. And so when she can't take it any longer, she goes over to him, pokes her head between him and the newspaper, and she says, pick a kid, any kid. And of course, he gets a little upset with that. And so then he's rebellious, and they have this little go-around. And I ask her, I said, what would your husband say if when he walked into the house, you just ask him very sweetly if he would watch the kids for a little while you got dinner? And she said, he would do it. And I said, well, what's the reason then you don't ask him? Women, what did she say? Mm-hmm. He should know. He should know what I need. Oh, ladies, how often has that gone through our mind? He should know how I feel. Do you know that after 38 years, my husband still says, honey, I can't read your mind. You know he says that? And I think, you should be able to by now. And then I think, nah, that's right. My friends, our purpose is not ever that we will think alike. If you think alike, one of you is unnecessary. Our purpose is that we will begin to think together, bring those wavelengths together. We will always be different. Praise God for our differences. But this may be something that you need to talk about, because that wife that I told you about right now needed to realize probably that her husband had an intense need to drop out maybe for 15 or 20 minutes and go and zonk out on the bedroom floor before she asked him to watch the kids. Maybe she needed to delay dinner. Now, if that's a friction in your household, that may be something that you need to read about and then discuss. Do you know your sweetheart? There can be physiological reasons why your husband may not be that emotional one that you are, wife. You're discovering now this left brain, right brain kind of thing. And they have made tests that look to be very true, that women from birth have better connectors than men do. They have bigger connectors from their right side and their left side of brains. And therefore, they're in touch with their feelings better than most men are. And so men develop one part of their brain to a more precise degree than most women. Now, if that proves to be true, we women who have gotten very upset with our husbands for perhaps not being able to verbalize their feelings as well as we can or to get in touch with their feelings, we need to be really more patient, because that's a physiological thing. And men need to work harder at it. So to blend together in this one. I just want to say that even in the physiological, there are certain things that we wives get kind of upset about. You see, man is built this way, with broad shoulders and narrow hips. That's the way his frame is. Women are built this way, with narrower shoulders and wider hips. Your center of gravity, that puts your center of gravity in a different place. A man's center of gravity is in his chest area. A woman's center of gravity is in her hip area. And that is actually why women can sit longer, more comfortably than men can. Have you guys ever gotten irritated with your husband when they started to wiggle in church or whatever? Well, see, that's a physiological thing that we need to understand about our sweethearts. I love Romans 15, 5-7. I'm going to change it slightly from the NIV just to give you a verse on your relationship here. May the God who gives endurance and encouragement give you a spirit of unity as a couple as you follow Christ Jesus, so that with one heart and mouth you may glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Accept one another then, just as Christ accepted you, in order to bring praise to God. Be kind to one another. Be understanding. Be as ready to forgive others as God, for Christ's sake, has forgiven you.
It should not be a surprise to those of us who are Christians that these differences that we've been talking about exist between us as people. I don't know whether you have ever read 1 Corinthians chapter 12, the last part of that chapter, and tried to put it into the context of marriage. But I'd like to have us try and do that this morning. If you've got your Bibles, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, and we'll start with verse 14. Now, this passage is a very deep theological passage. But at the same time, it has some very, very practical things to say to us in relation to the body of Christ. And for those of us here this morning who are believers in Jesus Christ, we are part of that body, married, unmarried, single, whatever. So as I read this to you, I'm going to read from the NIV. I would like to have you try and force yourself to think of this in terms of your own marriage relationship. and pull it out of the context that we usually think of this in, or where it is usually put by the pastor preaching on this particular subject from the pulpit, and he puts it into the context of the church, the body of Christ, being made up of people in a local assembly, perhaps. That would be one application. So divorce your thinking from that and pull it into the context of your own marriage and see if it doesn't really fit. Okay, here we go. Verse 14. Now the body is not made up of one part, but of many. If the foot should say, because I'm not a hand, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. And if the ear should say, because I'm not an eye, I do not belong to the body, it would not for that reason cease to be a part of the body. If the whole body were an eye, where would the sense of hearing be? If the whole body were an ear, where would the sense of smell be? You beginning to get the picture of that between you and your spouse? What are you, an ear? And what is she or he? Foot? A nose? Differences, huh? Verse 18, but in fact, listen to this, God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. And in a sense, I think that takes us back to Proverbs 27:17. Iron sharpens iron, and one person sharpens another. I don't know whether you have ever thought of your relationship in this regard, but way back in the past, God, through his miraculous creative endeavors, wired you together just the way you are, from your mother's womb. And somewhere else in the world, that person that you were going to marry was wired together the way they are, through God's miraculous creative endeavors. And then through a series of time and circumstances, you met and you fell in love. And then you got married. Now, what does God want to do with that? It says here, God has arranged the parts in the body, every one of them, just as he wanted them to be. And now he has plugged two of you together as parts of his body, whom he has wired together in probably very different ways. And so, you know, what does he want us to do with that? Well, let's go on. Verse 19, if they were all one part, where would the body be? As it is, there are many parts, but one body. The eye cannot say to the hand, I don't need you. Has it ever gone through your mind, just even a fleeting thought, I don't need her. I don't need him. Maybe not in general, but in some specific area. We do need each other. Verse 22, on the contrary, those parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. And the parts that we think are less honorable, we treat with special honor. And the parts that are unpresentable are treated with special modesty, while our presentable parts need no special treatment. But God has combined the members of the body and has given greater honor to the parts that lacked it, so that there should be, now look at these next two words, no division in the body. No division. But that its parts should have equal concern for each other. If one part suffers, every part suffers with it. If one part is honored, every part rejoices with it. What a beautiful picture of marriage. And there are two primary things, I believe, in this passage that God is trying to communicate to us. Two basic underlying principles that relate both. Number one, there is going to be great diversity. He takes the major part of the passage to describe that and to point that out to us. That there is going to be great diversity, which you have probably already discovered, as Carol and I have, in our relationship. There is great diversity. But the goal is to take that diversity and create unity out of it. No division, which means unity. And folks, I don't know whether we have communicated clearly to you yet or not, but to us, that becomes a lifetime project and part of the great adventure of marriage. It puts a challenge in it that becomes a lifelong adventure and experience together. To figure all that out, that God has done this, why has He done it, why has He brought us together, what does He want us to accomplish as a result of that? To grow together and to accomplish God's purposes. Now, I'm afraid that some of us, when we met, fell in love, she came walking down the aisle, you were standing here in the front of the church, you know, you were so excited and so caught up with the romance of it, and you'd had such long and interesting and deep conversations during the period of engagement, that many of us come into this thing called marriage feeling that we're going to be operating from the same script, much as two actors coming onto a stage to put on a production would. If we were sitting in the audience, we would obviously think they're going to be operating from the same script. It would be tragic if they weren't. But in marriage, probably nothing could be further from the truth. We come into this thing called marriage probably operating from two completely different scripts. And yet we sometimes fool ourselves into believing that that is not the case. I came across an article dealing with this several years ago in Redbook magazine. Redbook is not my favorite magazine, but it happened to be there, and I think it caught Carol's eye first. And this guy talks about this matter of scripts. He says, when two actors go out on a stage, we take it for granted that they both are going to be working from the same script. By the same token, when two people marry, they put down their $5 in a similar hope that they can take a particular script for granted. Unfortunately, the scripts from which each member of a couple plays her or his marital scenes are sometimes very different. In fact, I would say most of the time. The resulting scenes may be funny at times, but the whole performance is more likely to be awkward or even disastrous until the mismatching of scripts is recognized and taken into consideration and worked at and corrected. And then he goes on to tell a little incident that happened early in his marriage that portrays this, and it's so homely that I'm almost embarrassed to read it to you, but it's the kind of things that we run into. It's those little dinky things that happen that show us that we are operating from different scripts. He says, in the early days of my own marriage, I would have sworn that my wife and I had discussed every aspect of life and love. And here's the reason. We had known each other from kindergarten, dated from the 10th grade, and been engaged for a year and a half. You know, you would agree with him that they would have thought they would have talked about everything. But we never discussed what happens when you get sick. And if someone had suggested we discuss it, I probably would have laughed at them. Every right-thinking person knows what you should do when you get sick. You go to bed. That's your part. Then your mother or whoever loves you pumps you full of fruit juice. Well, I married this woman I'd known all my life, and in the natural course of events, I caught the flu. I knew what to do, of course. I went to bed and waited. But nothing happened, absolutely nothing. I couldn't believe it. I was so hurt, I would have left if I hadn't been so ill. Finally, I asked about juice, and she brought me some in a little 4-ounce glass, period. Now listen to this, because as I learned later, the only time they drank juice at her house was on alternate Tuesdays when they graced breakfast with a drop in a thimble-sized glass. My family's juice glasses held 12 ounces, and there was always someone standing around to refill them when they were empty. What a dumb little thing, huh? And yet it caused a conflict here, simply because of scripts. The family background plays a tremendous part in the development of differences that can exist between the two of us. Carol and I ran right smack into this shortly after we got married. Both of us were raised in Christian homes, and the older we have grown, the more we have appreciated that heritage. Our parents not only took us to church and to Sunday school and made sure that we made the young people's group on Sunday evening and at other times. But they lived in our homes the Bible. As best they knew how, they put the scriptures in the shoe leather in front of us. And, you know, at the time that was all going on, we didn't appreciate it. But as time has passed and we've looked back on it, we realize all that we have benefited and gained from that. And I think, as I mentioned yesterday morning, I don't think it's accidental that in Ephesians chapter 5, which we're going to be looking at a little more closely this morning later, I don't think it's accidental that God has chosen the marriage relationship to exemplify the relationship between Him and the church, between Christ and His body. And see, we have a tremendous influence on those lives that come into contact with us as a married couple, including our kids. Including our kids. And so we need to model what it is that God prescribes in His Word that He wants us to model, so that we can exemplify before other people who come into contact with us, particularly in our home environment, and then especially to our kids. Godliness, Christ-likeness, humility, hospitality, all of those gracious virtues that are explained to us in the Scriptures. But there was a significant difference, several of them, between our families and how we were raised. For instance, one of the things that came up very early in our marriage, I would say within the first 6 months, was the fact of how our two families showed appreciation and affection and love for one another within the confines of the home. See, Carol's family showed appreciation and affection by a lot of outward demonstration. There was a lot of hugging and kissing that went on in her family. I can never remember my dad hugging or kissing me until way, way later in his life. But when I was growing up and was still at home, you know, there may have been one or two occasions, but I don't remember it. Mom, on occasion when I was very young. Now, there was never any doubt in my mind that my parents loved me, but there just wasn't much hugging and kissing that went on, and that wasn't the way we did things in our home. So when the two of us met, fell in love, and got married, this thing began to show very, very soon. I will never forget the first time I went up to Carol's home for Christmas. She's got an older brother and a younger sister, and they were there, plus her mom and dad. There was a cousin or two and an aunt and an uncle, I think, that were all there for Christmas. And, of course, we knew who was going to be there, and we'd gone together and gotten each one of them a little gift for Christmas. And I'll never forget her brother opening his present from us. He was across the room. You know, there was this giant flurry of paper and being thrown into the air and ripping open the box and this great exclamation of how much he really liked this. And then he came roaring across the room and grabbed Carol and gave her a great big hug and a kiss. And then, guess who was next in line, huh? Oh, man, I tell you, I became a ramrod. I just stiffened. Telephone pole Mayhall, he was known as in those days. I just didn't know how to respond to it, especially from a man. But even with any sex, I mean, there's only two, but either one of them. Well, and at home, you know, I'd come in from work, and Carol, in her gregarious, outgoing way, would come running to the door and throw her arms around me and give me a hug and a kiss, and I could just feel myself tightening up. I did not know how to respond to that. I couldn't even get my arms around her. Well, that went on for several weeks, and I guess Carol finally just got a little tired of hugging and kissing a telephone pole. Now, in the bedroom, it was a different thing. That was a whole different ballgame. But this was kind of in public, and occasionally, you know, we'd have invited somebody over for dinner, and they were here early, and I just came in, and she would throw her arms around me, and I could see him out of the corner of my eye watching this, you know. Ooh. So we had to talk about this. Because, you know, she was getting tired of hugging and kissing a telephone pole, and she wanted to know if I didn't like it and wanted her to stop. Well, I'd already thought through on that. I did like it. That was the interesting thing to me. I couldn't quite figure that out. I'd never experienced this before. And I did like it, but I just didn't know how to respond to it. All because of family background. Well, we talked it over, and I told her I wanted to learn how to do this. And so Carol became my hugging and kissing coach. And over the next several weeks, then, she began to teach me how to do this. And, you know, I'd come in from work, and you know, I'd stiffen up, and she'd throw her arms around me, and she'd say, "Okay, now, honey, relax." So, you know, I'd kind of relax. And she'd say, "Now put your arms around me." So I'd put my arms around her, and she's, "No, a little tighter." So I'd squeeze a little bit. "A little tighter," she'd say. "Okay." And, you know, little by little, I'm exaggerating just slightly, but little by little, I learned how to do that. Until now, you know, after 38 years later, I can hug and kiss with the best of them. But, you know, I am so glad that I went her way on that one. Because the years have demonstrated that it was right. We have found ourselves numerous times over the years in usually social situations where if I was still a ramrod in a telephone pole in that kind of situation, it would have embarrassed some of the people who would have been there, and it would have been embarrassing to me and probably to Carol as well. I remember one time, 5 or 6 years ago, we were invited by a couple that we had gotten to know out here in the Broadmoor, which is kind of where, you know, the up-and-outers live here in Colorado Springs. They're wonderful people, and they invited us to come and teach a Bible study with a group of their friends, couples, on the subject of marriage for about 6 weeks. And so every Tuesday or Thursday night, I forget which it was, we'd go out there, and these people were very socially oriented. And so the very common thing for that culture when you enter the house is to give the hostess a hug and a kiss on the cheek. And then everyone who would come, all the couples would do that, coming and sometimes even departing. Boy, I was so glad I'd learned how to do that. It was very natural. No strain, no pain. But if I had not known, it could have been embarrassing to me, to them. And then one time we were in France, and good night. If you've ever been around the French people, you know that hugging and kissing is a way of life with them, on both cheeks, you know. We were invited by a young couple to be in their home one evening, and they had invited about 10 other couples in, and we just sat around the whole evening and talked about the subject of marriage and interacted with each other and coming and going. You know, it was a hug and a kiss on both cheeks. It took us probably 45 minutes just to say goodbye to that bunch. But I was so glad that I had learned how to do that. Now, I hadn't gotten the hang of both cheeks. That took a little practice, but you know, that once you got one cheek, well, you know, you can handle all kinds of cheeks then. So I don't know whether I've got a little story here. I want to read you something. I wasn't planning to put it in here, but it fits, and I think we've got time. Let me read you something for the benefit of some of you sitting there who are or may be like me in this matter. This is a little story I came across in Reader's Digest some time ago. It's about a father and son. It's not related to marriage, but it deals with this subject of love and the expression of love and somehow some of the ways that we need to overcome some idiosyncrasies that we may have. And of course, after you've heard it, you'll understand why I identify with it. We had always been a very proper family, never very demonstrative. We seldom hugged and almost never kissed. We men shook hands. Father taught us to give a firm, manly handshake and to look the other fellow in the eye while doing it. But as my father grew old, I saw that he became far less inhibited. He was not ashamed when others saw him weep. He finally found the freedom to take my mother's hand and kiss her in front of the children and grandchildren, something we never had seen him do in his younger years. That describes my dad to a T. Absolutely to a T. Dad even found the freedom to put his arm around a woman other than his wife, the wife he loved. Some may have equated his freedom with senility. I attributed it to maturity. Dad once told me that the older he became, the more he realized he had confused spontaneity with impropriety. Life is too short not to show your genuine feelings of affection. As I watched my father become free and felt my own life, my own love for him growing, I too longed to express my affection in a more meaningful way. Yet, every time I was with him, it came right down to saying goodbye. Instead of bending to kiss him, I always stuck out my hand. Even the words, "I love you," caught in my throat. I wanted to say them, but I was afraid to try. Finally, I could stand it no longer. My sophistication and twisted concepts of masculinity were choking me. One Saturday afternoon, I made a special trip to my parents' home 35 miles away. Walking into my father's study, I found him in his wheelchair, working on his ledger. "I have come for one purpose," I said. "I want to tell you something, and then I want to do something." Suddenly, I felt like a fool. I was 46 years old. He was 86. But I'd come this far, and I was not going to back out now. "I love you," I said, choking up. "Is that what you came to tell me?" he asked gently, putting his pen on the desk and placing his hands in his lap. "You didn't have to come all the way down here to tell me that, but I'm sure glad you did." "I've wanted to say those words for years," I said. "I find it easy to write them on paper, but it's been difficult for me to say them. Perhaps I needed to say it more for me than for you." His face grew pensive, and he nodded slowly. "There's something else," I said. He did not look up, but continued to stare straight ahead, nodding slowly. I bent and kissed him, first on one cheek, then on the other, and then on top of his bald forehead. He reached up, took my arms in his strong hands, and pulled me down to him so he could put his arms around my neck. For long moments, we remained in that awkward position. Finally, he released me, and I straightened. There were tears in his eyes, and his lips quivered as he spoke. He said, "My father died when I was a young man back in Indiana. Shortly after that, I left home to go to college, teach school, then go on to France in World War I. After the war, I moved to Florida. I never returned home except for occasional visits to see Mother. When she grew old, I invited her to come and live with us." He paused, and his face broke into a grin. She said, "No, I'll stay right here in this house, but I love you for asking me to come and live with you. Even though I'll never do it, I hope you keep right on asking me until the day I die." Looking up at me, my father said, "I know you love me, but I hope you keep right on telling me until the day I die." Something broke loose in me that Saturday afternoon, something that had been knotted up for years. As I drove home, I felt my spirit soar. At last, I was free too. And then this little statement: be a spendthrift in love. Love is the one treasure that multiplies by division. It's the one gift that grows bigger the more you take from it. It's the one business in which it pays to be an absolute spendthrift. Give it away. Throw it away, splash it over, empty your pockets, shake the basket, turn the glass upside down, and tomorrow you'll have more than you ever had before. Isn't that beautiful? And I know in an audience of this size, there's some of you sitting out there who need to learn how to show your appreciation with a hug. Someone else has written, hugs are not only nice, they're needed. Hugs can relieve pain and depression, make the healthy healthier, the happy happier, and the most secure among us even more so. Hugging feels good. It overcomes fear. It eases tension. It provides stretching exercise if you're short, and stooping exercises if you're tall. Hugging does not upset the environment. It saves heat. It requires no special equipment. It makes happy days happier and impossible days possible. How true, how true. Another difference that Carol and I soon learned about each other after we were married was this, what we know as introvert-extrovert difference. Now, this is one of the things in which we are significantly different, but which never reared its head as a problem. Interestingly enough, you know, some differences are like that. But we know that it is a problem in many, many married couples' relationship. We had a young couple come through town and visit us one time, and they stayed overnight for a couple of nights, and he and I were sitting there having breakfast or finishing up breakfast. The gals had gone off to do something, and he and I were sitting there talking, and he got serious all of a sudden. He says, Jack, could I ask you a very personal question? And I said, sure. And he says, well, I've noticed that your wife and my wife are quite a bit alike. And then he described this, what we usually think of as an extrovertish type of person, outgoing, talkative, energetic, relating to people easily, seemingly always to feel at ease in a crowd, that type of person. And he was right. That described Carol and his wife, Pat, to a T. Then he said, I noticed that you and I are somewhat alike. And then he described a more conservative, sort of what we think of as a little more of an introvertish, not exactly a wallflower, but, you know, more conservative, not so talkative, not so outgoing, not always feeling at ease in a group of people. And I agreed with him. We were pretty much alike on that score. Here was his question. He says, how do you handle that problem? Underline the word problem. I had never thought of it as a problem between Carol and I. But I drew him out a little bit, and I began to realize that in certain kinds of situations, he found himself intimidated and even threatened by his wife's outgoing, bubbly personality. Because he wasn't that way. And he didn't know how to handle it, and sort of looked at it as... What he was really asking me, how do you go about changing your wife? And of course, we talked about that, and I assured him that there was no way he could accomplish that. But what about looking upon it from a different perspective, as being an asset to your relationship rather than a problem? And, you know, I began to tell him a little bit about how I viewed it. And I said, for instance, it's a tremendous asset for me to have Carol the way she is in light of the way I am. I said, for instance, I hate small talk. That's probably a slight exaggeration. It probably isn't really hate. It's extreme dislike anyway. And I said, oftentimes we will find ourselves in a social setting with a group of other couples, and we're standing around just talking about this, that, and the other thing. There's nothing really important that is involved in the conversation, last week's football game, the weather, etc. And after about 10 or 12 minutes of that, I just begin to fade in terms of my interest in that. And so mentally, I remove myself from the situation and go back to the office and begin to work on some problem or decision that I'm trying to make, and I've still got a very intelligent look on my face. Nobody knows that I have left the scene mentally except Carol. She knows. There's something that she sees in my face or in my eyes that she knows I'm no longer there. And so she just kind of picks up on the conversation and says more and more and more, says enough for both of us. So they don't even miss me. And of course, invariably, someone will then ask me a question along the way. And I haven't even heard the question, let alone come up with an answer. But Carol knows this, and so she will say, "Honey." And that, from her, brings me to, and she'll repeat the question, and I'll give some answer. It doesn't make any difference what I say. It's small talk. And then I go back to work. I go back to work, and they go on with the conversation. Now, friends, that is an asset. Tremendous asset. So as I explained this to him, I think he began to see his wife from a different point of view than he'd ever viewed it before. And we've kept in touch with them over the years, and he did. His whole attitude toward her changed. And now he's got a tremendous respect for this wonderful gift that God has given him in this personality of his wife. I've got to call your attention to a passage over in 1 Peter that deals with this subject, just to make sure that there's no misunderstanding on this. 1 Peter chapter 3, the first few verses in this chapter are speaking about wives and their behavior and so forth, and their beauty. And in verse 3, he says, "Your beauty should not come from outward adornment such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes." Now, what Peter is not saying here is that there is anything wrong with those things. That's not his point. He is not saying that those things are wrong. What he is saying is that a wife, a Christian wife's real beauty, real true beauty, comes from something else that's within. That's within her. And that's what he talks about in verse 4. "Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight." In other words, a Christian wife needs to develop that inner beauty, a gentle and quiet spirit that is of great worth in God's sight. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think there is a difference between a gentle and quiet spirit and a gentle and quiet personality? I see some of your heads going like this, and that's right. There's a significant difference between a gentle and quiet spirit and a gentle and quiet personality. I believe that my wife, Carol, has a gentle and quiet spirit. I have seen her grow and watched her over the years develop an inner beauty and her relationship with God as she has grown closer to Him and allowed Him to invade areas of her life and deal with them and see her blossom and grow. And she has a gentle and quiet spirit. But folks, she has anything but a gentle and quiet personality. And I love her for both. Huh? What an asset. Yeah. So I just point that passage out to you because from time to time I run into a husband who is kind of trying to force his wife outwardly to conform to something that is talking about inwardly. It's an inward characteristic. It's not necessarily an outward character. It manifests itself outwardly, but not necessarily in terms of personality. It would manifest itself more in terms of character. And then we also from time to time run into some wives. We did just recently. I pointed this out, and one wife came up to us and she says, "You can't imagine what a relief that is." I'm so talkative. I'm so outgoing. I just can't help myself. But she says, "I've always been concerned about this passage." It's got nothing to do with that. Something inside. Yeah. Let me give you four words that will summarize everything that we have been talking about here this morning. And I've got to give you an assignment. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. Four words that summarize, and then a little story that describes all four of these. First one is knowing, K-N-O-W-I-N-G. Carol talked about that. She quoted that pastor's wife, "Study your man or your wife as though they were some wild, exotic, fascinating creature," which they are. That means stand back, study, observe them, watch them in action. How do they handle situations differently than you do? This takes observation. Takes study. Takes time. Takes commitment. Takes working at. All right, that's the first word, knowing. Second word is understanding. Understanding goes deeper than knowing. Understanding requires at least two additional things than just standing back and observing. It requires communication and prayer. In order for you to really get to know what is going on inside of your marriage partner, you've got to talk about things that draw one another out. There's got to be in-depth communication. Getting into the why of things. Why? Not only what they did the way they did it, but why they did what they did the way they did it. And in order to get at that, you've got to talk. You've got to interact with each other. And then secondly, I think all of us need to pray for understanding and wisdom. It is, after all, God who has wired that person together. He's made them the way they are, and He understands them far better than we do. And that passage that Carol mentioned this morning is a choice one. James 1:5, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all men liberally, and it shall be given him. So let's ask God for wisdom to understand that person we're married to. The third word is adjusting, being willing to change. Are we really committed to change? I've run into some husbands who have sort of have this attitude. Look, she knew how I was when she married me. She can learn to live with it. What a tragic attitude toward life. What a tragic attitude toward marriage. Boy, we go through life and never change. For the better, we are, of all people, most miserable. So are we committed to change? To give and take? We as Christians, for the most part, don't like the word compromise. But, boy, it's a very applicable word in terms of marriage. Maybe negotiate would be a better word, more acceptable to us, I don't know. But there's compromises. We've got to give and take and be willing to change. Sometimes one of us, sometimes both of us. The fourth word is accepting. This is an aspect of love, I believe. The acceptance of the other person in those areas which they can't change. That's really the way they are. Now, none of us has the right to use that as an excuse. Look, that's the way I am. There's hardly any area in our life that cannot in some way be improved with God's help. But there comes a point when acceptance really becomes an issue of love with the other person. Several years ago, Carol and I were coming back from a two-week trip down to Florida. It was in January, latter part of January. We'd been down there for 2 weeks. We'd been involved in all kinds of things, ministry, conferences, some counseling, some business meetings with the navigators. And we were worn out, tired, ready to get home. And so we were flying from Orlando to the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport, DFW, and then from there on into Colorado Springs. And we had to stop and change planes in DFW Airport. Well, as we were coming into land, the pilot came on the intercom and he says, "Look, folks, the Dallas-Fort Worth area has experienced in the last couple of days one of the worst cold spells they've ever had, and sleet and ice, and things are not too well down there. The runway is icy, so hang on to your seats. Be sure your seat belts are fastened." And so we got in, and he was right, boy. It was kind of an antsy landing. And we walked into the airport. We were already about 2 hours late. And we walked into the airport, and he was right, boy. Nothing was working. The heat was not on. The clocks were not running. All the airplanes were late. And if you've ever been in DFW, you know that you get from one terminal to another on these little trains that take you around. Well, the trains weren't working. So we found ourselves standing outside in the cold, waiting for a bus. We both felt the same way. We were tired. We were frustrated because of this dumb situation. And you know, when you're headed home after a long, hard time on the road, you know you want to get there. And the whole thing was a mess. And so there we were, standing out in the cold, waiting for this bus. And I'm standing there with my hands in my pockets, looking down at the ground, very quietly. Carol is standing next to me. And next to her is a little old lady who is very concerned about whether or not she's going to get home that night. And everything was running late, and she was concerned. You know, she was late getting in. Will the plane be late when I get there? And so Carol was trying to encourage her and cheer her up. And she said, "Don't worry, sweetheart. You know, everything is going to be all right." Everything's running late. The bus will be here in a minute. It'll get you to your terminal. You'll get home tonight. And, you know, on and on. Yak, 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 yak. This is what's going on over here. Well, finally, this interference over here began to penetrate my thinking, and I began to be bothered by it. And so I took my hand out of my pocket, and I kind of doubled up my fist, and I just nudged her on the thigh. And in nonverbal communication, that meant, shut up. And she got the message. She did shut up. She hardly talked to me the rest of the way home. Within 10 seconds after I'd done that, I knew that I had made a terrible mistake. And it was wrong. So I began to try and apologize. And, of course, how did she read that? You remember what her number one primary way of my communicating love to her is? Acceptance. What was it communicating to her? That nudge on the thigh. Non-acceptance. By me. I was sure not communicating love. Well, I tried to apologize. We got on the bus, put my arm around her, gave her a little hug, and told her I was sorry and that I really wasn't thinking about her. I was thinking about myself. Please forgive me. And she kind of grunted. And I apologized a couple of more times after we got on the airplane. And finally, by the time we got home, about 2:30 or 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, 3 or 4 hours late, everything was okay between us. There was harmony. There was peace. There was forgiveness. And so we laid our heads on the pillow with everything okay between us. We have made it a practice of our lives to follow the scriptural admonition over in Ephesians that not let the sun go down upon your wrath. And, you know, I have to admit, sometimes the sun has set very late. But we have always followed that. Now, most couples that we talk to, when they have gone through a situation like that, real conflict has arisen between them, and then they work their way through it and they get it resolved, they are so relieved when it's over that the thought of going back to that is the furthest thing from their mind. And so they put it behind them, they press ahead and go on with the rest of their life. Now let me tell you something, folks. If we do that, we are passing up one of the greatest opportunities to really get to know each other that we'll ever have. Conflict situations that arise primarily because of differences between us are opportunities for understanding, provided we're willing to go back and pick them up and talk about them and communicate what was really going on inside of us. And so the next day we did that. After a good night's sleep, the next day, sometime during the day, we came back to the Dallas-Fort Worth experience and we began to talk about what was really going on inside of us. See, we both felt the same way, but our response and reaction to the same set of circumstances was entirely different. I was quiet and remote and detached, and Carol was talkative and effervescent and outgoing. We both felt the same way. We were tired, worn out, frustrated, anxious to get home. Same circumstances, we were both cold. But why the difference? Okay, here's what we discovered by talking about it. I explained to Carol what was going on while I was standing there with my hands in my pockets looking down at the ground. I was trying to solve this problem that we had. I was having an imaginary conversation with the airport manager. And he and I were trying to figure out how to get the trains running again. How to get the clocks running. How to get the heat back on in the airport. How to get the airplanes back on schedule and get out of this mess that we were in. See, I am by nature a problem solver. That's part of my makeup. My daughter has told me at times, she said, Dad, if you didn't have a problem to solve, you'd find one. And she's probably right. Well, I had one there, man. It was a beauty. Now, when I'm really intently involved in something like that, I don't like outside interference. And that's what I began to get, all the static over here. And that's why my fist on the thigh. Very gently, by the way, it was. Now, that was wrong. And I, as I told you, I had to apologize for that. Then as we began to draw Carol out, and she began to explain to me what was going on inside of her and why she did what she did, which was totally different than my response. The bottom line was that we discovered that the way she handles a frustrating, out-of-control situation is by forced cheerfulness from within. She forces herself inwardly to be cheerful about this. And that usually manifests itself in finding someone else to cheer up who's in the same boat. And that helps her. And so here was this little old lady next to her. And so she was cheering her up, and that helps Carol cope. Now, apart from the nudge on the thigh, let's erase that one. Let's forget that. That's all taken care of by apology and forgiveness. But apart from that, whose approach was right and whose approach was wrong into the handling or the coping with the situation? Neither. Not wrong, just different. Huh? But most of the time, folks, we have a tendency to look upon those things as wrong in our partner. When if we would only take the time and the trouble to really pursue it, to investigate it, to draw one another out. Now, I know those are hard things to do sometimes because the emotions get so involved and so wrapped up in it. But we need to go back to those situations and draw one another out and find out what was really going on. Now, if you begin to feel emotional about it, one of you starts to get mad, one of you starts to cry, then, okay, back away for a few hours or a day. But come back to it again when you can get into it unemotionally and really discover what was going on. You see, I not only by talking about that with Carol, I not only learned what was going on inside of her, I learned in a new way what was going on inside of me. I learned something about me, and she learned something about herself, as well as learning about each other. Of course, near the end of that conversation, Carol asked me the question. She says, "Well, sweetheart, next time that happens, what do you want me to do?" Now, gentlemen, when your wife, under those circumstances, asks you that kind of a question, that is loaded, boy. I tell you, it is loaded. It's like a double-barrel shotgun. And you better give some serious thought to your answer, because your answer is going to make a tremendous difference in those kinds of situations in the future. And they are going to repeat themselves, just as ours did. So after giving a little careful thought to that, I said, "Well, honey, I want you to be yourself." And I really meant that, because now I understood. I knew now where Carol was coming from, and that made a lot of difference. And I knew that she knew where I was coming from. And sure enough, about 3 months later, we found ourselves in a very similar situation. I was standing there, hands in my pockets, looking down at the ground, trying to solve this dumb thing that had happened and the situation that we were in and figure it out and try and get it resolved mentally. And she was next to me, and next to her was a little 12-year-old boy who was lost. And she was cheering him up. And pretty soon, you know, I began to hear all this over here. It began to seep into my thinking. But see, now I knew what was going on, huh? What a difference that made. And so mentally, I just kind of said to myself and smiled inwardly. I didn't say this verbally. I just said it inwardly. "Sick of money." Boy, what a different response, huh? Why? Because now I understood. I knew what was going on over there. And I realized, you know, she's got just as much right to cope with her, with this situation in her way as I do to cope with it in mine. Not wrong. Just different. Huh? You don't remember anything else we say this week. If you remember that, go a long way toward helping. But those four words we need to work on constantly: knowing, understanding,